You are in the Senate Education and General Government Committee. Welcome. Please turn off all cell phones, PDAs. You must know that by now. This far into the session, if I hear it, I'll ask you to make a contribution to the Common School Fund. If you're here to testify, you sign up over there. Okay, because all of our committee isn't here yet, we're going to skip the work session for now. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2583. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2583 allows a public agency entering an agreement for joint and cooperative action with a public agency in another state to require the other state's public entity to indemnify the public agency in this state against tort claims. This is something that Senator Metzger can speak to.
Yeah,
says Metzger.
All right. You know, there's a town named after you.
Hello, Madam Chair and duo of the committee. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and Representative Smith called. He couldn't be here today, so this is my responsibility today. This bill is actually quite simple. Came to us unanimously out of the House. It regards the issue particularly around the area of first responders on our border states. An issue was brought to us by the folks at Hood River, where they have reciprocal assistance, and I think this is very typical of other border communities where you have maybe fires or emergencies on the highways and you need to get people there immediately and they're right there. The problem is that when our people go over to the state of Washington to assist, whether it's an accident right across the river or a fire or another type of emergency, there's a great concern because of the into an intergovernmental agreement is to make sure that our folks are indemnified against any action in which the state of Washington may have different, legal parameters for them performing their own work. And all this bill does, it says, is that if the public agencies enter into an intergovernmental agreement with another state, that part of that agreement must indemnify our own emergency workers for any actions that they perform in the course of their professional duties so that they're not at risk, because that puts them on a real damper when they want to come over and they want to assist, they want to provide emergency aid, but they're worried about their own liability. And this simply says that if they make those intergovernmental agreements, that an equal indemnity for the two states must apply so that there is no concern from those who are asked to perform the duties.
Okay, I have a curveball to throw at you. What about OHSU?
OHSU.
Yeah, Oregon Health Sciences University. Our state goes into Washington State to assist somebody. The medical personnel take them to Oregon Health Sciences University, where the victim has no idea that there's a tort cap at OHSU, and if they are mistreated, they only get to sue for up to $100,000 and an additional $100,000.
Well, that is a curveball.
It came to me this morning.
Of course, this bill only applies to the responders, so it doesn't apply to the individuals that you're talking about, nor is the individual who is the patient, what you're referring to, and what their responsibilities would be. This would be the firefighter or the EMT that assisted this person in getting them in the ambulance.
Okay.
This is what that agreement would cover. It would have no impact on that individual one way or another.
Okay. Well, I would like it if the first responders would alert the patient before they take them to OHSU that they're about to enter the no man's land of not being able to sue for an injury that they receive at the hands of the physician or the hospital. But we don't have that in this bill.
Yeah, that's true.
The relating clause. Well, I don't know.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
I just have to question your characterization of the curveball. That was more like a Bob Feller. You know,
knuckleball.
Loaded up. Yeah.
Yeah.
It had brass knuckles in it?
Yeah.
I just needed to get it on the record.
Or spitball.
Yeah.
All right. Well, as long as we're talking about just the responders, but it'd be nice if they'd carry a little notification card if they
depending
transport.
Depending on their chest as they're coming on the life flight helicopter.
Yeah. Run. Are you sure you want
you
to
sure
go?
You sure you want to go there?
Go there. Yeah. They are a fine university hospital, teaching hospital, but they make mistakes like everyone else. But unfortunately, they're the only hospital in the state where you don't get to file a lawsuit against them for any amount above the tort cap.
Well.
Yeah.
Closer to home. I mean, you're in downtown Portland, you fall off the curb, you break your leg. Responder shows up, you don't know where you're going. Could be Legacy, could be Emmanuel. Well, Providence
next time,
or OHSU.
Make a request. Carry a badge. Senator Metzger, thank you for this bill.
Thank you. I'll come back up.
Okay.
Are we actually going to pass this bill, Madam Chair?
I think so.
Oh,
Senator has a problem with it.
He loves it.
8-3.
Just say yes.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2583. I'm going to open a work session on 2583.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2583 to the floor with a due-pass recommendation as Senator Cruz gets up to speed here.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. Senator Metzger moves House Bill 2583 to the floor of the Senate with a due-pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Just a comment, Madam Chair. Senator Metzger is doing an awful lot of talking this morning.
Okay.
I'll make up for it the rest of the meeting.
Yeah. Balance it out.
Senator Cruz, it doesn't...
House emergency
responder.
Yeah, okay. You read the bill before he came to the committee. And I just threw a curveball about OHSU just to get my little dig in.
Okay, I was trying to look for that, and I didn't see it in there. You never know what amendments are going
to
show up.
I know. I just needed to get that on the record because I'm feeling like not enough people understand what's going on there. So, okay. No further discussion. Ms. Gravel, take the roll, please.
Aye.
Senator Morris? Oh, excused. Somehow.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2583 is approved. It's headed to the Senate. Senator Metzger, you can carry it, and I promise I won't ask you about OHSU as you carry the bill. Okay. Well, I'd like to do that work session. We've got at least four or five members here. House Bill 3466, I'll open a work session. This Great Soil and Water Conservation District bill. Did you get that all figured out, Senator Cruz?
We think we're okay.
Okay. Let's ask Ms. Richardson to tell us about it then.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill that we heard a week ago today. It appoints the Department of Agriculture to deliver and prepare the information for Soil and Water Conservation District Board elections. It allows a person to file a document and receive write-in votes for Soil and Water Conservation District Director position if no nominee for the position qualifies to have their name placed on the ballot. Provides for declaring director positions vacant and for filling vacancies prior to scheduled term expiration. When we last saw this bill, we had the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments before us, and the dash 3s are meant to get us all the way to where it's a good bill to move forward, so I'll speak to those briefly. The dash 3 amendments specify that persons filing a request to tally write-in votes must file the declaration with the Department of Agriculture at least 14 days before the date of election. Directs the department to determine whether the person requesting the tally of the write-in votes meets the qualifications to become a district director. Requires the department to notify county clerks to count the write-in votes for the qualified requester. And it prohibits the county clerk from tallying any write-in votes if there is no nominee and no person who qualifies after filing a declaration that specifies in that case that the position shall be filled by appointment.
Okay.
Crystal clear?
Crystal clear. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, tell us. Just for curiosity, because Dana put four there, and we are dealing with three.
Oh, I thought
we
had four, yes.
Okay. Well, I know that was a potential, so.
Okay, so we're not doing a dash four?
No, we
we're
have
okay
a three.
With a dash three?
Yes.
And this is pretty much essentially what we talked about the other day.
Yes.
So if you want your write-in votes tallied, you have to write in and request it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm sure I move the dash three amendment to House Bill 3466.
Senator Cruz moves the dash 3 amendment to House Bill 3466. Any discussion? I'm sure that counties will appreciate this bill because it cost, I think the testimony was Multnomah County, it was costing them $20,000. And this came out of Lane County. So I'm glad we are able to fix this problem. No further discussion. Ms. Gravel?
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3466.
That was the amendment.
66. The amendment is adopted.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3466.
You didn't think I knew that, did you? I almost didn't.
None of us thought you knew that.
Well, when you called the roll on an amendment, I thought you might have been
asked. Yeah, I wasn't thinking. So this morning I'm waking up.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3466 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
There we go. Now we've got it. House Bill, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3466 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, and we all know what's going on now. Any further discussion? Okay. Call the roll. Twice.
Senator Meister?
Aye.
Senator Morris?
Excused.
Senator
Weston?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz? Aye. You're chairing. Okay, now it's approved. House Bill 3466 goes to the floor, and Senator Cruz, you're carrying it.
Okay, thank you.
And you can tell us all about your history on the Soil and Water Conservation District Board.
Boy, that'd put the chamber to sleep, wouldn't it?
Okay, with that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 3466, open a public hearing on House Bill 2776. Is Representative Shields here yet? He is not, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2776 and await the arrival of Representative Shields. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 353. I love using this gavel. That's the problem.
I still hate to do this to Madam Chair, but Representative Esquivel wanted to testify.
Okay, we have representatives who are missing in action, so we are closing the public hearing on House Bill 3538. I could just throw the gavel.
You know, Madam Chair, it was back into the 2001 legislative session when we were near the end of session. I was serving on Senate Judiciary, so we have time here to talk. And Senator John Minnis was chairing that committee, and we had, as you always do in judiciary, lots of bills.
Yes.
And members who, you know, wanted to testify on bills, and you didn't have a lot of time, and they weren't always there. And when Senator Minnis would open that hearing on the bill, he would kind of give a 3-2-1. If they weren't there, the gavel would go down, dead bill, next bill.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of huffing and puffing as people would run into the room, having heard their bill had been killed, begging on their knees for Senator Minnis to reconsider. Sometimes he did, and sometimes he didn't. It's all a matter of making sure you're there when the time is right.
That's exactly right. And we all appreciated that about Senator Minnis. The man who knew what he wanted. Okay, well, we're going to the last one on our list. Since no one's here, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3178. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3178A requires public bodies to make available to the public lists of vacant and unused buildings and portions of buildings that may be suitable for operation of a public charter school. Directs that the list be provided to developing or operating charter schools within 30 days of a written request. It requires the public bodies to enter into good faith negotiations with a public charter school or a charter governing body with an approved charter proposal for lease, use, or purchase of space.
Okay, Ms. Hikus, you are up. You are the only one here.
Madam Chair, I'm assuming.
She's here.
I'm assuming because you're one of the sponsors, this must be a really good bill.
Well, you might think that.
Good morning, Senator Walker, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. And I just wanted to also let you know that CSDC requested this bill based on input that we received from folks regarding their priorities. We do want to thank Senator Walker for co-sponsoring this bill along with a number of representatives. And we would like to respectfully request that this committee would also support this bill. As Ms. Richardson explained, what this bill would do is require school districts and other public agencies to make available a list of buildings or portions of buildings that the agency or the district deems to be available and to be potentially suitable for public charter schools to lease or purchase. And basically what the bill does is it requires districts and public agencies to treat charter schools as any other prospective tenant or buyer. It doesn't ask them to give charter schools any preference one way or the other. As you know, facilities is the number one challenge cited by charter schools in this state and also across the nation. And this is one of those in the House. We talked about the starfish analogy, you know, when you throw the starfish back into the water, it doesn't save all the starfish, but those that do get saved, it makes a difference for them. This is a bill that will make a difference for some schools, won't cause harm to any, those that will make a difference, too, will be a huge difference because facility, again, is the number one challenge charter schools faced. Most of our charter schools, well, not most, but 60%, so the majority of them already locate in public buildings, in district buildings, and so most of our districts are already very cooperative and supportive of letting charter schools use their space either at free or reduced costs. We do have some that have not necessarily operated in good faith around this issue, and that's why we have this bill. And again, what it does is it asks districts and other public agencies to operate in good faith, which I'm not an attorney, but my understanding is in good faith is best defined by what it's not more than what it is, and that it's not being capricious. It's not going into the situation with your mind already made up. So that's what the bill does, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you would have.
Okay, I do have a question. I have in my bill file a letter from Portland Public Schools that urges us not to support this bill as written because they're concerned about, I think they're concerned about the words "the space" down on line 37, and I think they also may be concerned about what good faith means. So did Portland Public Schools testify on the House side?
No, they didn't. They sent a letter as well, and if it's the letter I saw, it's not signed by anyone. We're not sure who actually wrote the letter, but it's on PPS letterhead.
It is.
Okay. I think they misunderstood. If I recall the letter, I think it says that they think the charter school would define which buildings would be available, or something like that, which isn't the case. The public agency would decide which buildings would go on the list. If the building's not available for anyone to lease or purchase, then it's not available for charter schools to lease or purchase.
Okay.
So I think they might have misunderstood, if it's the same letter I saw.
Okay. Well, it raises a significant question for me, but I don't see Portland Public Schools in the audience. Does anyone here have a question?
Madam Chair, there, one of the bullet points is it would allow the charter school to select property to be taken out of the market or out of reserve, and I don't read that in the bill.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just allows them to go into negotiations with the public entity on rent or purchase, and it's still willing seller, willing buyer sort of concept here. So it's not forcing anything to happen.
Mm-hmm.
If they can't agree on a rent price or a purchase price, they aren't compelled to rent or sell.
Right.
That's the way I read the bill.
Let me ask you what line 35 means when you say good faith negotiations. How would that be defined?
Well, again, I think good faith is best defined by what it's not. And, it's, that it's not going into the situation with a predetermined outcome. Presumably, it would mean that districts or other public agencies would use their policies, their procurement policies, their policies for surplus unused property, and that they would treat the charter school as any other prospective tenant or buyer. That's what I think good faith means in this situation. But again, not an attorney.
Oh, I see. Well, it looks like I have not the A. Engrossed copy in my file. Is that fascinating or what?
Yeah.
So the space is missing on line 37 because we don't even have line 37. Well, we've got a lot more lines.
Right. I think it's...
Okay. Well, somehow I didn't have the A. Engrossed version in my bill file, which I reviewed last evening.
Hmm.
So I'm going to need to just hold this so I can take a look at the...
Sure. The primary difference is just that the last line of the bill, lines 41 through 43, which was never intended to be left out. It was never intended to propose that we remove that line from statute. So in A. Engrossed, it was just restored.
Yeah.
But nothing requires the owner of the building to lease or sell.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's the difference.
Okay. Well, I don't think there's a problem, but because I was reviewing the wrong bill.
I think she was right. I think it's just... Everything mm-hmm. we read was there, and then it's just the addition of this last sentence.
Mm-hmm. Next time I'll look to see that there's an A on top of that, though. I would have thought that was in my bill file. All right, thank you, Ms. Eichert. Thank you for questions. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3178. Representative Shields here? Anybody? Okay, well, we don't have anything else.
I could call Representative Buskerville's office. We just didn't have a chance.
We'll stand at ease. Back in session, we'll open a hearing, a public hearing on House Bill 3538. John Enders, Andy Shaw, and John Phillips. Come on up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3538 permits the creation of heritage districts, allows heritage districts to be formed by two or more counties, provides for heritage district board membership, election, and powers. It authorizes heritage district boards to assess, levy, and collect taxes to pay the cost of acquiring, constructing, altering, operating, and maintaining heritage sites and structures, to establish and maintain heritage society programs, and to issue general obligation bonds not to exceed 2.5% of market value of taxable property within the district. It limits the taxation to maximum of 0.25% of the market value of taxable property within the district. And I'll just note that this bill, if the committee likes it, does need a conflict amendment and couldn't be moved to a work session today.
Okay. John, who wants to start?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Enders. I'm from Ashland. I'm the executive director of the Southern Oregon Historical Society, and I'm here to speak enthusiastically in support of this bill. Essentially, what it does is allow the voters of any county to decide to support heritage and history in their own jurisdiction. It's an enabling piece of legislation that allows people to decide that history is as important to them, preservation is as important to them as soil and water conservation and other districts. The Southern Oregon Historical Society is in support of this bill. The Oregon Historical Society is in support of this bill. The Oregon Heritage Commission is in support of this bill. And the Oregon Museums Association is in support of the bill unanimously. The House passed it 55 to 2, and we're hoping that there are some minor concerns from the Department of Revenue that we have no objection to. There are some other concerns, substantive concerns from the League of Oregon Cities that we are concerned about. We believe the bill as it stands is a good bill, and intend, as soon as we're enabled to do so, to go to the voters of Jackson County to create a heritage district and allow us to create a funding mechanism for, with voter approval, a funding mechanism for 15 historical societies in Jackson County. It's also a bill that would allow jurisdictions throughout the state of Oregon to do something that is extremely difficult to do now, and that is pay for preservation and conservation and heritage and history, which always takes a back seat. Again, it's a piece of enabling legislation. It allows the voters of a county to create a funding mechanism for heritage, and we very, very strongly support the bill. I'm sorry, but I was notified of this hearing at 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. I don't have any written testimony. Otherwise, I would have brought it.
Okay, well, we actually don't need written testimony. You did just fine, Mr. Enders. Thank you. Mr. Shaw? Or no, who wants to go next? Mr. Phillips.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. We did meet with Representative Escobar.
He just walked in behind you.
And testified on the House side about one issue on page 4, the last line, the start of the sentence. It continues on page 5, the first two lines. And that is a kind of an out-of-context exception to the public budgeting law. It says there that this certain type of fund need not be budgeted. And we think this is a kind of an exception to the rule about public budgeting and getting information to the public about what the money the taxing districts are using. We talked with members of the district, and they were fine with having this edited out. I've not seen an amendment.
He says it's on page 4.
Line 45. The balances.
Thank you.
And then lines 1 through 6 on page 5?
1 through 2, I'm sorry.
1 through 2, okay.
Ending with the word district and
just
period.
That sentence then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, so you want that sentence to read how?
Just to be
deleted?
Removed. Yeah. And that's just a matter of public policy for you to make, but it would be an exception to Chapter 294 of the statutes, which outlines public budgeting law and requires all funds to be budgeted so that the public knows what the districts are doing with monies on an annual basis.
Okay.
And that's your only objection?
It's my request, yes. Okay. Otherwise, the bill is fine, and I think counties can administer it.
Okay, great. Representative Escobar has joined us, so we'll see if he likes your idea.
Well, I only heard part of it, so I'm not real sure.
Well, tell us who you are first, Representative.
Representative Escobar, representative of District 6, Medford. This bill, I'll give you some background. I don't know if it's been explained to you how this bill happened. 1948, Jackson County allocated 25 cents per thousand, excuse me, for their historical society. The commissioners, after Proposition 5, took the money, put it in their general fund, and then did not continue to fund the historical society.
Ooh.
So since they did not have a district, that's what we're trying to establish here, so they can have their own standalone district and take care of their own needs, wants and needs. And, of course, it'll be up to the voters themselves. This, I thought, was irregular, and I thought it was a travesty for the state of Oregon in all historical societies throughout the state, because our heritage and our history is a very important part of us as we function. So that's how we got here. I don't know what has been outlined here.
Before you go on, Representative, let me ask you. You said in 1948 Jackson County allocated 25 cents per thousand. Did they do it by a vote of the people?
Correct.
I see. And then the county just sua sponte decided to take the
After
money?
After Proposition 5, they rolled it into the general fund and then cut allocations off for the historical society.
Wow.
But they didn't give the money back to the voters either.
So the voters are being duped at this point, thinking they're putting in 25 cents per thousand for a historical society?
Madam Chair, it was very, very public. Everyone knows exactly what's going on, but that's up to the commissioners. So.
Is that a line item on your tax bill, that it's 25 cents per thousand going to the historical society?
Not anymore.
It's been eliminated.
That's correct.
And they just kept it.
Correct.
Well, I just don't think that's fair.
I kind of agree with you, Senator. That's why I'm here.
I gotcha. This is sounding kind of like a fun little bill. So I'm real interested to hear what Mr. Shaw has to say.
Well, Madam Chair, this panel's here. I just find it interesting. The two no votes on this bill were from the House Minority Leader and the Chair of the House Revenue Committee. And you don't often find those two voting together on things.
Yeah.
So
I noticed that.
Madam Chair, what was their objection?
I have, of course, accused them of collusion, but thus far that hasn't been the case. Actually, the chair of the Revenue Committee misunderstood what the bill was about. He admitted that afterwards.
Okay.
And why the minority leader? Who knows?
Well, Madam Chair, it's just that's a very strange combination to be isolated like that. It did pose a question.
Okay, great. Well, we don't have anybody from the county here. We have someone from the city. So maybe we'll find out why the cities object. Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Andy Shaw with the League of Cities. I can't speak on behalf of the county or the counties. I do know that part of what happened with Measures 5 and 50 is you took all these existing levies that existed and rolled them into one and capped the rate that counties, cities, special districts, other taxing districts could levy. So that's what caused the special levy for this purpose to be lumped in with the county's general levy. As you know, under Measures 5 and 50, cities and counties are capped as to what we can raise. The permanent rate freeze means that we can't increase the basic rate to fund services as service costs are rising across the board, and especially in public safety and road maintenance. It's increasingly challenging to fund the services that local voters desire. Our concern with this proposal relates to compression. When a new permanent rate is established, in areas where compression exists, it will cause all permanent rates to be reduced proportionately in order to accommodate that new rate. We had proposed on the House side a change to the bill to the way compression works now. You first compress all local option levies. When that is exhausted, you then go to the permanent taxing rate, taxing entities. We proposed an amendment to say compress those local option levies first, then compress this new kind of district, and then finally compress the existing taxing districts. That would hold harmless the existing taxing districts from the effects of compression by establishing a new taxing district pursuant to this bill. Those amendments weren't ready for the committee. The committee did express an interest in agreeing with those amendments, possibly on the Senate side. Of course, they don't have the power to do that. Since that time, concerns have been expressed by county assessors as well as the Department of Revenue about how that different process of applying compression would work, and we understand those concerns, and maybe that's not the best the best way to address our issues. We think there are other approaches to funding this kind of service. The folks locally or the county could pursue a local option levy to fund the service, or this bill could be limited just to the county of Jackson or those counties in southern Oregon that are interested in pursuing this option. Number of counties elsewhere are experiencing significant levels of compression, and to expand the scope of special districts to allow funding this kind of service could affect those existing taxing districts through compression. And I think at a broader level, part of what we're seeing is measures 5 and 50 affecting the options we have to fund services. Most of the special districts that exist are there to fund services that can be provided either beyond the city boundary or beyond a county boundary in a geographical area where that makes sense, whether it's a fire district like Tualatin Valley Fire District that serves a number of communities and that gives you some economy of scale in doing that, or makes some geographic or other, it makes sense for other reasons. Here we're seeing more, I think, an attempt to find a funding source for an existing service that the county has chosen for whatever reason to no longer fund, as opposed to coming at it from the angle of here's a service that is needed in this particular area that's either inside or outside other jurisdictions and therefore requires a special district. So with those concerns expressed, we would hope you'd help us pursue some other solution to this problem by either limiting the scope of the bill or suggesting that that folks from the Historical Society seek a local option levy or some other solution like that. Glad to answer any other questions.
Okay. Well, I'm first going to let Representative Esquivel have a comment about that. Were you privy to this kind of conversation in the committee before on the House side?
We discussed it briefly, although we never came to any conclusions. We have yet to see any amendments. But, Madam Chair, upon doing some work with the assessors, first of all, what they're saying is the Heritage District would be the last on the boat, so it'd be the first one we'd throw off the boat. That's what they're saying. It's up to the voters, I feel, in the state of Oregon to determine what their compression ratio is and what they want to do with their money. If the voters have the opportunity, and this is a permissive bill, you don't have to do this. It's up to you and your county. Put it out to a vote. Establish your district. Compression will be talked about. I have a couple of things I'd like to read from you from the assessor's office in Jackson County and Union County. As the League of Oregon Cities, want compression to work on the local option levies first, then the heritage districts, and if any more compression is needed, it would be taken from all the districts as it always has been. That's the way they feel it should be done. We don't need another special district category with another compression method. This causes them great complications with their computerization and their formula funding. The last question that both the assessors brought forth was, why should a permanent rate for a new district be treated any differently than any other permanent rate? Good question. This is a situation of where the League of Oregon Cities are looking out only for their special interests, which is, of course, our cities, which is a great part of our society. But the voters are not ignorant. The voters will get an opportunity to discuss compression. The voters will make up their own mind, and it may not pass.
Okay. What do you think about eliminating the sentence on line 45 up to lines 1 and 2 on pages 4 and 5 that the Department of Revenue testified about? Were you in the room?
No, I was not, but I... Line... What was that?
On page 4, line 45.
Line 45.
The sentence that... the last sentence where it begins the new sentence, the balances to the credit of the funds need not be taken into consideration or deducted from budget estimates by the levying authority in preparing the annual budget of the district. The Department of Revenue says that needs to be deleted.
No, no. I don't have any heartburn with that.
Okay. Well, especially since the Department of Revenue feels that it's necessary to facilitate the bill. Okay. So any questions from the committee? We've had some interesting testimony. Yes, Mr. Hendricks.
Can I respond to a couple of the
sure.
League of Oregon City's concerns? I agree with Representative Esquivel that what we're trying to do is not just for the people of Jackson County. It's to create a statewide mechanism where local voters can decide on their own. We are as concerned with the heritage of northeastern Oregon as we are southwestern Oregon. We're also strongly opposed to being put in a situation where we are a separate second-rate district. We think Heritage District ought to have all the rights of all the same districts as outlined in enabling legislation already on the books. So again, we're very much in favor of this bill. Thank you for hearing our testimony.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any other questions, comments?
Well, Madam Chair, based on the witness's testimony, it seems, you know, he's not concerned at all about the heritage of the Willamette Valley or Central Oregon in particular. So, and we love, you know, southwestern and northeastern, you know, heritage as well. You know, all this Central
Madam
Oregon.
Chair, I congratulate you for keeping this going.
It didn't escape my attention, Senator Wilson, that they conveniently left out the.
I think we knew his testimony was encompassing.
Yeah, I think so.
Everything in between.
Though, unfortunately, my city got rid of much of its historical property in urban renewal. It's just an absolute shame. And Jackson County is just resplendent in historical properties. So, okay, well, we obviously need a conflict amendment that Ms. Richardson talked about with another bill. And we need to delete that sentence. And, Mr. Shaw, I'm not getting the sense that my committee is buying into your concern. If they were, they'd have some comments about it. So I think you win some, you lose some. I think you lost this one. I think we're going to allow the voters to get back what they had in 1948. So I will close the public hearing on this. We'll get that amendment. Representative Esquivel, would you work with my assistant, our assistant here, and make sure our administrator, and make sure we get things taken care of, and we'll bring this bill back. Could we have it by Thursday? Okay, we'll roll it over to Thursday.
Thank you.
He needed it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, just for the record, you see who does all the heavy lifting when it comes in at the end.
I just noticed that. Representative Buckley, did you need to speak on the record?
I'm not fine. Just if you need a comment, I'll be brief.
Yeah, you have to tell us who you are and all that. We know who you are.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County. I want to thank my colleague from Medford for doing the heavy lifting on this bill. This does have the support of the Southern Oregon delegation. We appreciate your consideration.
And you're aware that the cities are a little bit...
The cities do have a concern. And
twisted about this.
They do have a concern, and we're trying to listen to their concerns. Again, I look at this as a local decision for folks in whatever county would want to put this on the ballot, you know, for their historical society, that would be their decision.
Mm-hmm.
But we're totally willing to listen, to work with anybody to get through.
Okay. Well, I think our committee kind of agrees with that. And I figure if somebody did this in 1948, they were thinking, they were forward thinking, and then the money was just taken from them.
Well, Madam Chair, there was lots of money back then because we were cutting trees and doing all sorts of things.
No. All right, I think we're closing this public hearing. Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3538. We will roll this one over to Thursday because I anticipate the fine, excellent counsel in Legislative Council will get us an amendment that will take care of it. Okay, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2776A. Representative Shields and Ms. Richardson will explain the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2776A extends the option for disadvantaged minority women or emerging small businesses to not obtain a public work bonds from 1 year to 4 years following their certification. Allows a contractor or subcontractor not to file the public work bonds for projects with a contract price that is less than $100,000.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill so quickly after it passed the House. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, State Representative from District 43, North and Northeast Portland, and I thought you wouldn't mind if I brought Ms. Adamson-Harris up to talk about AGC's position on the bill as well.
I don't mind at all.
House Bill 2776A is good for small business. In the past session, we passed Senate Bill 477B, the prevailing wage bill, and in that bill was an exemption for minority women and emerging small businesses from getting a prevailing wage bond of about $30,000 to cover wages in case an employer couldn't pay them. That one-year exemption for those businesses, however, once we went back and looked at it and got some feedback from some of my constituents who were minority contractors, they felt it wouldn't be as useful to them as perhaps it was intended, because it is an exemption from the date you're certified as a minority, women, or emerging small business, not from when the bill went into effect. So what this bill does is say we're going to extend the window from when you're certified to 4 years. That was the compromise of some of the parties involved. And that would give an emerging small business, a minority-owned business, and a women-owned business more time to actually get a government contract, because what we found is that there are a large number of minority contractors particularly weren't getting their first prevailing wage government public contract until, say, year two, year three, or year four. And I just wanted to also thank AGC and the building trades for coming together to work with me on this over almost a year's time. And this bill also is very important to the minority chambers of commerce, who have made it one of their priorities for moving the minority business agenda. And lastly, Senator Carter, Gordley, and Winters, I've discussed it with them, and they're very interested in the bill as well. And Jessica can talk also about the amendment.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson, here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. As Representative Shields indicated, this public works bond was established in 2005 as one of the components of Senate Bill 477. What a public works bond is, every contractor and subcontractor on a prevailing wage job, which are jobs over $50,000, is required to post with the Construction Contractors Board a bond in the amount of $30,000. That bond is there and available in the event that there is a claim at BOLI for wages that may not have been paid on that prevailing wage job. BOLI has a right of action against that bond first, and then against the project-specific prevailing or payment and performance bond second. All public contracts require that the owner obtain a performance and payment bond from the general contractor. If there aren't wages paid, BOLI attaches to that payment bond that's only required of the general contractor. In the past, prior to the public works bonds, if a subcontractor or subcontractors failed to pay prevailing wage, nothing went against them. It was against the general and the general alone, because they're the only ones with a public or with a payment bond. We're the only ones required to have the payment bond. That had been a frustration for the industry for quite some time, because it's our contention that everyone should carry their own weight and be responsible for payment of prevailing wages. That we believe that's important, and the accountability should be on everyone, not just on the general contractor. So we established the public works bond as a way of saying, for consistency reasons, we'll say $30,000, because Boley indicated to us that that's about the average claim size, that $30,000 will be available. They won't have to post it on a per-project basis. They'll post it once. It costs about 3% of the bond to post that. It's there. It's available solely for that purpose, and it gets attached there first. The concern was that small and emerging businesses wouldn't be able to obtain it, so we created the one-year exemption. We're happy to have worked with Representative Shields to better meet the needs of that community. The bill also establishes an exemption below $100,000. Again, public works jobs don't start until $50,000. So anything under that wouldn't have a bond anyway. But the request of affordable housing folks, and at the request of school districts who have jobs in the $60,000 to $70,000 range, that are usually you get a boiler or some big piece of equipment, you get a small amount of actual wages on a large piece of an equipment that you're installing, and trip the prevailing wage threshold, and they'd have to have a bond. And for some of these companies, they do one or two jobs a year, and the profit that they make off of those jobs is less than the cost of public works bonds. So we felt that that was unnecessary, and it was a hassle for those small governments. So they have asked us to exempt everything from $100,000 down from the public works bond, and we've agreed. So that is the context of the public works bond, why we put it in place. It is proven to assist in trying to ensure that everyone takes responsibility for paying wages accurately.
Okay. Any questions? I remember Senate Bill 477. That was my bill.
It was a great bill, Senator Walker.
Yes, it was. It became the big, huge public contracting bill of the session. Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if we extend this to 4 years before they have to post, where does remedy come from?
Senator Walker, or Chair Walker, Senator Cruz, the general contractor assumes the risk at that point in time. What this will mean, we will know, because we can go on to the CCB website today, and for our subcontractors, there are one of two indications. Either yes, they have the public works bond, or no, they don't because they're certified ESB. If we know that we've got an ESB on our job site and they don't have the public works bonds, we're going to be taking a much closer look at their certified payrolls to make sure that they're accurate. It's a way for us to do more spot checking with that contractor and a little more hand-holding.
So basically, for the small exception, Madam Chair, it's back to before her bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, correct.
Sometimes the things we fix need further fixing. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's been my experience that most of the work is performed by these DBEs as subs to generals. Is there anything in this bill that would prohibit the market from essentially working with respect to the requirement of a performance and payment bond?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, no, the general could still require a performance and payment bond of that sub should they so choose, and it doesn't, in the event that they work as a general, exempt them from the requirement to obtain a performance and payment bond directly for the owner's purposes. It merely says they don't have to post the bond specifically at the CCB for the purpose of the public works bond.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Have any concerns, Senator Morse?
No, I you know, we all recognize that every business that was ever started small. Mm-hmm. And small businesses sometimes need a little help. I know that in our company, we did extensive contracting, and we oftentimes had disadvantaged businesses that we employed as subcontractors, and we did a lot of hand-holding and in many cases joint checks to help them, so you don't wind up, when you waive a performance and payment bond, you're at risk as a general contractor, so you step in to help to make sure that things are done right, and that's kind of an assistance that the general provides. And that's why I asked the question, is to make sure that there was nothing that interfered with that market relationship between a subcontractor, disadvantaged, and the general contractor.
Okay. I couldn't have said it any better. In fact, I liked what you had to say about that. And you have a lot of experience in working with contractors in your former line of work. Okay, any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you both for coming. I appreciate it. Yep. And I get the sense we like this bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2776A, open a work session on House Bill 2776A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2776A.
It's a mouthful.
It is. To the Senate floor with the pass recommendation.
Great.
Oh. Is this that Chip Shields bill?
Yeah. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2776A to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Nope. Ms. Gravel?
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator
Warren?
Aye.
Senator
Lester?
Aye.
Vice Chancellor? Aye. House Bill 2776A is passed on its way to the Senate, and I'm going to have Senator Morse carry that since he spoke so eloquently about the need for such things. Okay, we are going to carry over House Bill 3178 that we already heard because I just need to look at that language a little more carefully since I did not have the A in gross bill in my work file. And we'll carry that over till Thursday. Do we have anything on Thursday's docket? A little bit. We're not getting a lot, colleagues, because we're not being sent a lot. So,
sorry, Madam Chair, we'll also carry over.
We're also
353A is, I'm sorry, which is the one that we need?
3538, you're right. Correct. That's the one on the Heritage Districts where we need to delete that sentence and get a conflict amendment. Okay, I think we're done.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
I'd just like to make an observation.
Mm-hmm.
That for the first time in the history of our committee, we have no one in the hearing room.
What can we do?
We've outlasted them.
There is something we can do.
So you can wield that gavel and make some announcement and get all kinds of people here.
Yeah. Why don't we
open our hearing on workers' comp today.
Yeah, why don't we have we could open up a hearing on all kinds of things. I think the Senate President's office would run right down here and tell us we didn't properly post that. So.
I have everything.
All right, committee. Well, you have an hour.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
I believe I missed a vote on House Bill 2583.
Yes, you did. And also, were you here for the Soil and Water Conservation District vote?
No, he wasn't.
No, you were not.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
I move the rules be suspended to allow Senator Morse to vote on House Bills 2583 and House Bill 3466.
Senator Cruz moves the rules be suspended to allow Senator Morse to vote on House Bills 2583 and 3466. Any objection? So ordered. Senator Morse, how do you vote?
Aye and aye.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you for the motion.
You're welcome. And enjoy your hour. We'll see you on Thursday, everyone. We're adjourned.